My name is Gene, and I, too, am an alcoholic.
Hi, Gene.
Meeting on anonymity will be right after this meeting, you know. Whenever I identify myself as an alcoholic, I always do that based on how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic as it's defined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking, and that's all it says. Does it make any reference to how much we drank, what we drank, where we drank, or what happened as a result of our drinking? It doesn't say in order to be an alcoholic, you got to live on Skid Row, drink wine, spend weekends in drunk tanks, marry the same woman 4 or 5 times, you know. So by that definition, I'm an alcoholic. I've got it sort of easy tonight because a couple of people have asked me to talk about something in particular tonight, and I don't usually get anybody to sort of request anything in particular, but it might be a good thing, even me for myself, because ironically, I was in a little argument with a couple of new guys this morning over this. Many times we hear things in Alcoholics Anonymous that can be taken wrong, you know, and we call them misconceptions, and they cause a lot of controversy. One of the most popular, I guess, you hear around is these dummies that run around saying there are no musts in AA, when I could show you at least 57 of them in the book Alcoholics Anonymous tonight if we had the time to do it. And then you hear other jerks telling you, you know, don't make any major decisions during the first year of your sobriety. You got to make more decisions during the first year of your sobriety than you're going to do in the next 99 years. Of course, what they're trying to tell you there, of course, is don't make any major decisions without first consulting with your sponsor or some other knowledgeable sober member of this program. And then one that's sort of a pet peeve of mine, you know, they say there is no guarantee in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly am not going to try to rewrite the book or rewrite the program. And they've been saying that since the beginning of time, that there is no guarantee. There's no such as a sure thing. There's nothing that's positive, you know, in our program. And I'm just cocky enough to argue that. I believe there is a guarantee in this program. I believe the answer to our problem is given to us in this program and then left for us to decide whether or not we want it or not. And it's right there in the fifth chapter of this book. It's right there in the portion of that fifth chapter that is read at most AA meetings where they list the three pertinent facts. And if you've been listening to that at any of the meetings you go, they tell you the answer. You come in here the same way I come in here. It's described very much as people, you know, who are trying to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, you know. We're all F-word up, you know, bad shape. Looking for an answer. And if you open up your ears when they read that fifth chapter, you will hear the answer. Quote. Before I make the quote, we have to set the scene right because there are a lot of new people in this room tonight identifying themselves with 30 and 90 and 60 days of sobriety, so maybe they're not yet aware of who wrote this book, whose words that we quote all the time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or do we make reference to the big book, who we're making reference to? Remember who wrote this book. You know, Ernest Hemingway didn't write this book. James Michener, or the Pope, or Martin Luther King, or Brigham Young, or the Pope, you know. Approximately 53 years ago in a room, probably no bigger than this, 79 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, men and women, sat down and put into that book their experiences, their strengths, and their hopes. That's who wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Conceivably and hypothetically, if we could push the clock back, you know, 53 years right now and take all of you out of here except 79. The remaining 79, you would be the people who wrote this book. And none of you could have been sober more than 2 years, because the book wasn't written until AA was 2 years old. And of course, all of them weren't sober for 2 years. Many of them had slipped and slud like many of us. They were a representative group of Alcoholics Anonymous then, as we are now. All different things. I believe that the miracles now that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe the second miracle that was created in our program plus I've always said the first one was when Bill was put in touch with Dr. Bob through Henrietta Cyberling, making that phone call. Then the second miracle, I believe, and I was told this by my original sponsor, who was a founding member of AA in Chicago, and he said that there was much controversy amongst the 79 men and two women, you know, in the writing of the book, just like alcoholics would argue. They had all different opinions. Some wanted pictures in the book. Everybody wanted a story in the book. Egotistical jerks, you know. And other people wanted royalties and commissions. A lot of turmoil took place. And then this miracle took place. Can you imagine this? In order to stop the arguing, they said, well, to satisfy everybody, let's not put anything into the book unless we all agree on it. Can you imagine getting 79 alcoholics to agree on something? Try getting four to agree on something. But yet it happened. Yet it happened. And in that group were atheists, agnostics, believers, non-believers, true believers, members of the clergy, a group just like you are. And they agreed that nothing would go in there unless they all agreed. So I quote you the second and third of the three pertinent facts at the closing portion of the fifth chapter read at most AA meetings. And remember, it's the words of you who said this. We believe, that's an odd word right off the bat for an atheist and an agnostic. We believe that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. That's what you said. Well, that poses a question right away then. How am I going to recover? If the doctor can't do it, the clergy can't do it, the sponsor can't do it, Bill Wilson can't do it, Bob can't, who the hell can do it? And then they told us the answer plain and clear. They said, but God, and they called him God, they didn't call him a chair or a rock or a tree or a telephone pole or a poster. They said God could. You can't get any more definite than that. Can I be helped? God can. That's what they're telling you. God could and would. That takes away any doubts. That's the answer. That's saying, here it is, right here. That's the answer to your problem. And then wisely and divinely guided, they put that decision right where it should be. If he were sought. In other words, they told us where the answer was and they told us how to get it. And then they let us decide whether we wanted to make the move or not. Simple. But how do people like me and you react to authority? And that's what God is, a supreme being, the great lawmaker. And I was no different. I came in here when I was 24 years old, wise ass, cocky little shithead, you know. Knew all the goddamn answers, you know, didn't need any help from him with the assholes like you, you know, what the hell do you know? You're all losers, you know. You're all losers. I'm hip slick and cool, I'm just experiencing some bad turns, you know, right now. That's how I thought it was. And as a result of my, what does the book say? Persistence in an insane illusion that somehow, someway, someday I'd once more be able to enjoy and control my drinking, I wound up doing things that are described very well in the foreword to the first edition of the book. where it says, we are quite sure that the accounts of our experiences, commonly referred to as drunk-along in AA, as a result of my total denial, I had to pay the price that I had to pay. I certainly am not going to sit here and stand here for the rest of the night and talk to you about prison, about Skid Row, and jails and institutions, and all that sort of garbage that became part of what the book also says is countless vain attempts on my part to prove that I could drink like a normal person, you know. And then it turned around. It took me 6 years to get my first year of sobriety. And a lot of dedicated members of Alcoholics Anonymous worked with me. And I'm just going to bring out, you know, the sickness. And I'm going to have to bring it out, not have to, but I want to bring it out with the use of a vulgar word. And I'm not going to do this to prove to you that I can be vulgar. I just want to prove to you how sick and how self-centered and how egotistical people like you and I get. I spent almost a year and a half of my life on Chicago Skid Row, West Madison Street. And them guys in AA were always around, you know. I used to call them cherry pickers, trying to, you know, get somebody and take them to a meeting. And they used to hang out in front of the blood bank up there in the corner of Broadway and Wilson. And I had occasion to be visiting that blood bank on as many occasions as I could. To sell my blood for a lousy $4 so I could get enough wine to last till noon anyhow. And this one day, the man who was eventually becoming my sponsor was working with me there, and he was pleading with me, and he had known me for all those 6 years. And he was saying things like, Jesus, Duff, you know the program as well as I do. You understand the steps. You do this, you do that. He says, the only thing you don't seem to be able to grasp is, you know, he says, turning your life and will over to the care of God, if you understand him, you know. He said, Jesus, if he could only get that Duffy, you know, slap in his hand. No. Now listen to this. I'm sitting there on the curb. I'm homeless, jobless, useless, hopeless. Nobody wants me. I don't want anybody. I got no place to go, and I wouldn't go there if I did. I am at my bottom. This guy is saying, why won't you turn your life and will over to the care of God? I said, suppose he fucks it up. And that's the total arrogance of people like me and you. Every one of you in this room, maybe you wouldn't have said it, but you would have thought it the same way. You know? And I kept telling him, I said, I don't want to hear this God crap. You know, if you want to give me a buck or a pack of bucks to buy me a drink, fine, but don't lay this God shit on me. Now get the hell out of here, you know. And he kept persisting like them old-timers do, you know, as they do. And he kept hammering away at me because he was dedicated, and he was, of course, like us, you know, looking out for my welfare. And then he said, come on, you can't deny the existence of God. And I said, I don't deny the existence of God, Bob. I said, I never have. I said, I believe in God. I was taught about God in a parochial school. I was taught about God in a good, loving Christian home. I said, I have no doubt that God exists. But what I can't accept is that God has power. Because God, to me, is a statue. And I'm going to say some things in the next few minutes that might sound blasphemous, that might sound to some of you that I'm mocking some form of a religion. But I assure you I'm not. I'm bound by a moral obligation for the love of my program to tell you the truth. And I'm going to tell you the truth. And I'm going to tell you why it was so difficult for me, and then how it did turn around. How it finally turned around. Because Bob kept saying, you can't keep saying that. He says, there had to be times in your life when you called upon God. And I said, no, there's not. I said, what are you talking about? You talking about roller skates and a new bicycle at Christmas, for Christ's sake? I was raised in a depression. My folks didn't have nothing. So don't give me this crap about talking about God and all of this. And he says, come on, there has to have been times. And I says, no, there isn't. Now get out of here. I says, the closest I've ever come to this God kid was a coincidence. And that's a word you should never say around an old timer. Never say that word, coincidence. Because he just reared back like a thoroughbred, and he said, why don't you tell me about that coincidence in your life? And I guess more and just to get rid of him, you know, just to get it over with, so he'd give me some money or something. I told him, I says, well, Bob, I says, you're not going to understand this. I says, but I'll tell you anyhow, just so I can satisfy you. I'm born and raised in the Lower East Side of New York City, which is not exactly Disneyland, you know. And as I said, I was raised during the Great Depression, which you're getting sort of a taste of right now. But things were bad. And my brother Jack, and of course this is long before the introduction of antibiotics and penicillin and stuff like that. My brother Jack, who's 5 years older than me, came down sick with double pneumonia and streptococcus. And in those days it was fatal. You know, there was just nothing that they could do for these people. They didn't let them die. And because we were poor, you know, there was no county hospital or anything like that. The common practice in those days was the city or the county would furnish you a hospital bed to put in one of the rooms of your home, and then a county nurse would come around maybe two or three times during the week and administer some medication or give directions to my mother or whatever. And then I don't know how often the doctor came around, maybe once a week or twice. I don't really know. And that's how it was. My brother was laid out in a hospital bed in what my mother called the parlor. It was the front room of our little cold water flat that we lived in, and I was only 7 years old. So I probably didn't understand the finality of death or the seriousness of it, because I didn't really pay that much attention to my brother, you know. And my brother was there for almost 3 months in the parlor. And finally one night, when the doctor was visiting there, mother always used to send me out into what we call the kitchen, you know, to get out so I couldn't hear. But I was listening, and I heard the doctor tell my mother that my brother Jack was going to die that night. That his lungs had filled up with water, and that he was drowning from the pneumonia, and that he wouldn't make the night. Now, I wished so hard that I could have cried then, or displayed some kind of compassion, but I didn't understand. And I just went off to bed like any other night, and got up the next morning, and the mother sent me off to school like any other morning, and I didn't even look in to see if my brother was still there. I just didn't think about it. And I went to a parochial school, Our Lady of Victory parochial school. And one of the little things that kids in, I guess, in any major city that don't have money, you know, on the way to school, you steal money if you get a chance. So you can buy the most precious thing in the world for seven-year-olds, and that's candy. And I used to steal pennies off of the news racks, you know, in front of the different stores on the way to school. And that morning, I stole 5 pennies and put them in my pocket. Now, in a parochial school system, you have to go to mass every morning at 8:00. It's the longest half hour in history. It's a half hour that seems like it's 15 hours long. You know? Oh, it is horrible. And I was raised in Little Italy, what they call Little Italy, you know. And I sort of, you know, I could blame that for a lot of my alcoholism. You got a name like Duffy, and you live in Little Italy, you better bet your ass you got to come out fighting every goddamn morning. Them little dagos were always after my ass, and most of the time they got it, you know. And so the church that I went to, Our Lady of Victory, was a predominantly Italian church. And so the custom was all of the kids had to go sit up in the front rows in the center of the church, and the nuns sit at the end, you know, and they hit you with a stick, you know, put your baseball cards away. No talking, stop chewing gum and all that kind of shit. And you're sitting in there, you know, you're counting the ceiling tiles, you're counting the color of the pictures, you know. Anything that's past that half hour, you know, because it just drags, you know. And then one of the things that I found to entertain myself during that half an hour was watching the Italian women mourn. Italian women have to be the greatest mourners in the world. And I really mean that. I really mean it. Maybe not so much anymore. But in those days, and I'm talking about the 30s, you know, as soon as an Italian died, boy, whoosh, black. Everything came out black. And black wasn't in vogue then, black stockings and things like that, you know. And I used to hear them. I couldn't see them because we weren't allowed to turn around inside the church, otherwise when the nuns crack you with that stick, you know. You had to keep your head looking ahead all the time. But I could hear the Italian women coming down them side aisles, you know. And they come down there shuffling, you know. Crying, rattling a big bead. And I'm not trying to be funny or be facetious. It's just how much. Then they disappear into the corner. And I couldn't see them anymore. But you could hear them. And I noticed something then. Little did I ever realize how important it was going to become in my life later on. It's probably the only thing I really remembered out of that whole incident. I noticed that when the Italian women left the church, they didn't leave on the aisles that they came in. They would go to the front of the altar, and they'd kneel in front of the altar, and they'd turn around, and they'd leave right through the center of the church, coming right past me. And I'd be down there like that, you know, looking up at them, you know. And you know what I noticed? That when they left the church, they looked better than when they had gone into the church. Something happened in the corner of that church that changed them people. And I didn't know what it was, and I quite wasn't really interested in finding out at that time. But it must have slid back in there and lodged someplace in one of them memory shelves. And it lay there for a while. When Bob kept pressuring me about this God, and I told him about that, I said, Bob, how could I believe in God? I said, I'd kneel there in church and I'd look up and I said, all God was a plaster of Paris statue. Every place I looked around in the church was a statue. And I used to wonder why my aunts and my uncles and my mother would go in front of these statues. And they'd pray for this, you know, say, what the hell are they expecting? That goddamn statue is going to get off the wall and do something. You know, that's how a 7-year-old kid thought. And so I sort of denied automatically the power of God. The recognizing of it and the accepting of it, no problem. But hey, don't ask it to do things for you. You got to do the things that have to be done. Not a hunk of plaster. And that's a lousy attitude. Lousy attitude. So when Bob asked me to talk some more about my brother, I told him that. I had left the home, the house that morning and went on up to school, went through the 8 o'clock mass, went through the school day, and got out of school at 3:15, walked down to the corner, was waiting for Mr. Schaefer, the cop, to give me the signal to cross over and go on down the hill and go on home. And I was standing there on the corner, a little 7-year-old kid, and all of a sudden the realization that my brother might be dead fell heavily on me. God Almighty. I imagined him being covered with dirt. I thought he was probably in the ground already, and I loved my brother, you know. And I was just, you know, an inch short of panicking. And I looked up and I realized I was standing in front of the church. And then I remembered the Italian women. And I remembered the corner of the church. So I turned around and I went inside the church. And I wasn't allowed to go down them corner aisles because I hadn't received my first communion yet. So it took a lot of courage on my part to look around and make sure there was no nuns or priests around. And I darted down there. And I got down to the railing. Total disappointment. Because I expected to see something different down there. And it was just more statues. A whole lot more statues. I had been programmed to automatically kneel down when you come to the railing, so I had knelt down. And I know, and of course I'd be a liar if I told you I could remember this second by second, but I'm pretty sure, I don't know what I did, but if I did, you know what I think? I think that day was probably the first time that I participated in what I would refer to as real prayer. You see, I had prayed as the nuns had taught me to pray, and as you had been taught. I knew all the things that rhymed and all the things we had to memorize. Those things where you all stand up like we'll close this meeting with, you know, murderers, if he'll get through as quick as, without even knowing what the hell I was saying half of the time. That afternoon, I participated in the real meaning of prayer. Because, see, prayer is nothing more than talking. Prayer is talking, and meditation is listening. That's all it is. And I think that afternoon, I talked to somebody. And I don't know if it was a statue or what, but I talked to somebody about my brother. And I didn't want my brother to die. And I asked somebody not to let my brother die. Then when I got all done, I noticed there was a big brass thing right alongside of me. It had looked like a thousand candles in it. Half of them were lit, half of them weren't. And it said, offering 10 cents. I fingered them 5 pennies I had. Must have figured as a kid I should get it half price. So I put the 5 pennies in there, and then I lit every candle that wasn't lit. And I left. And my brother Jack is alive. As a matter of fact, I spoke to him today. He lives in New York. Had a wonderful career. He's a retired officer, elected officer in the International Longshoremen's Union in New York City. And he had a marvelous career. Done good, honorable man. Never had any problems in his life, you know. And he didn't die. But I wouldn't be that egotistical or self-centered to think that my brother's alive, you know, because of my friend. I'm quite sure my mother and my father and my aunts and my uncles and a lot of other people with a lot more sincerity and a lot more often prayed for my brother than I did. So I told Bob, I said, see, you know, that's just a coincidence, Bob. Just the doctor was wrong. It has nothing to do with prayer, Bob, and nothing to do with it. And he sort of had that old-timer smirk on his face. And he said, well, he says, you were seeking it. He says, and that's what it says. God could and would if he was sought. But yeah, but that's just, you know, forget it. And he says, you mean there's no other times in your life when you didn't call? I says, never. I said, that's it, so stop pushing. I said, if you're talking about that time, and he said, what time? And I said, that's nothing to do with AA, nothing to do with AA. Tell me about it. And I said, well, I was in that same school. I said, but now it's a few years later, and I'm supposed to graduate and go out of the eighth grade into the public school system, into high school. And here it's the last day of school, you know, all the kids are in the eighth grade, we're anxious, and here come the nuns down through the aisles and handing out their report cards, you know, all the kids letting them know that they're going to go to high school. And they went right past me. And then the head nun came over and handed me a letter addressed to my father. And the letter, in so many words, said something like this. This is to inform you that your son Eugene will be held at the eighth grade level for one more year. It's a decision made by the faculty of Our Lady of Victory School due to his inability to successfully complete the course in English. Left back. Disgraced. My father would have read that letter this way. Dear Mr. Duffy, because you are a dumb son of a bitch, your son is a dumb son of a bitch. And he would have split my head wide open. Now, you'd have to understand the fear I had at that time for my father. Jesus Christ, you know. I thought about what the age limit was for the Foreign Legion. Or, you know, or is it true that if you keep digging a hole, you'll come to China? You know, anything rather than have to hand him that letter. Because I was terrified to hand him that letter, you know. Oh, God Almighty. And Mother had given me a nickel to take the streetcar home because it was the last day of school and had to carry old busted books and the busted loose leaf binders and the one sneaker and the torn t-shirts and all them valuable things you bring home, you know. And so I started out of school and got down to the corner waiting for Mr. Schaefer to give me the signal to go across, and I'm half bawling thinking about my father. All of a sudden I turned around and I realized again I'm standing right there in front of that church. I thought about them Italian women. I thought about my brother Jack. I thought about the corner of that church. So I turned around and I went in the church and I put my stuff down in the vestibule and I went right down the side aisle because I'd received my communion by then. Went right down there and again I knelt down there and I talked to somebody. And I didn't recite all of the things that I learned, you know. I told somebody that was listening to me that how ashamed I was, and how scared I was, and what a fool I knew I had been. And I don't have another chance and things like that. Then I took the 5 cents and I put it in the tube and I lit every candle that wasn't lit again. And then I left the church and went down the hill, rolled a few fake tears down my eyes. The streetcar conductor let me on for nothing. So I'm on a trolley car, and I don't know if there was any other seats. Mustn't have been, because why would I share a seat with somebody that was already in it, you know? But I sat down and shared this seat, and with a guy, a great big guy. God Almighty, he's a big man. And I'm holding all of my crap on my lap, and this trolley car is trundling along, and made a few stops, and then all of a sudden this big guy said to me, he said, "You just getting out of school for the summer?" I said, "Yeah, that's right." And he says, "Boy, I'll bet you're happy." And man, that was like taking your finger out of the dike, you know. Boom, it just poured out. I just cried like hell. And I told him everything I just told you, how scared I was of going home, you know, and the fear I had and the shame I had. And he listened to me. He listened to me. And when I got all through, he said, "Well, didn't anybody tell you have an opportunity to go to summer school?" And I said, "What's summer school?" He said, "Well, you can take the course that you fail in 8 weeks." And he said, "And if you pass, then you'll go on and get promoted." I said, "Well, how the hell can I pass something in 8 weeks that I couldn't pass in 18? He said, "Well, you have to do things different. He said, you'd have to leave the baseball cards home. He said, you'd have to stop looking out the window. He said, when you're given lessons to take home and do it, now you take them home and do them." And I can understand that. And I said, "Oh, do you really think that if I did those things, I'd pass?" And he says, "I'm quite sure you would." The guy that I was sitting alongside of in that streetcar that day, his name was Hamilton B. Ryder. He retired 14 years ago as the superintendent of schools in Mount Vernon, New York. But the day he was sitting on that streetcar with me, he was a young student teacher, just assigned to teach his first course in English for the summer school session. Very important man in my life. He was a very important man in my life. I maintained a contact with him all during my life, you know. Well, as you know, then by now, Bob's got me. The coincidences are not coincidences. But I'm still having problems. You keep saying, "Bob, as I understand him. God, as I understand him, not as I see in that statue." I said, "I cannot accept this statue, Bob." He says, "How do you understand God?" And I didn't know. Didn't know how to understand God. You know, what is God? I've never seen God. Is he here? Or where the hell is he, you know? You don't hear him. And he says, "As you understand." And then one day it happened, as you've heard many times in AA, you'll hear, you keep coming to these meetings, and it'll happen. I don't know how many AA meetings I had been to up until this time, but all of a sudden we got ready to close the meeting, and the chairman said the usual crap. "Let's close this meeting in the usual manner with a large prayer," and we all got up. "Our Father..." First time in my life I ever said the Lord's Prayer and listened to what the hell I was saying. "Our Father, our Father, God as I understand him. And please allow me to tell you about my Father. I loved my Father more than anything I've ever loved in my life. My Father was the most important thing in my life. Everything that I would ever even dream of wanting to be would be just like my Father. Now, in the eyes of the district attorney of the state of New York, my Father was a criminal, and he had to pay an awful price for that. awful price for that. But for many of the people that I've ever been associated with, they said that my father was more of a Robin Hood than he ever was a criminal. But the district attorney didn't, and he had aspirations on being president of the United States, and he used my father and some other guys as stepping stones, you know. But I never knew my father to be a criminal. My father stood about 6'4". He must have come in at about 240, and every inch of him was a man. I know that. And I had heard, and I had known, and I read in the papers, and people would remind me that there were times when my father was involved in violent things, I guess. But I never saw that. I only knew my father as a gentle man. So gentle. The thing that I remember about him so much, you know, was one hot summer night, and it gets hot in New York City in the summertime, and that's long before air conditioning. And so in attempts to cool off, you know, people who lived in the tenement houses like we lived would, you sort of strip to the waist, you know, and you go down and you sit on the stoop, the stairs in front of the building and hope for a little nighttime breeze, and the fire department comes around and opens up the fire hydrants and the kids run in and out underneath the water just to try to cool off. So we were sitting down there. Now, I never really got to spend too much time with my father due to the nature of his activities, I guess. But whenever he was there, I was right at his side, And I can remember that night sitting there alongside of him in that hot night. And my brother Jack was raising pigeons up on the roof of our tenement house. And all of a sudden he came down, crying like hell. And in his hands he had his favorite pigeon. And the pigeon couldn't fly. He put it down on the pavement and it would just hobble along. And it had gotten its wing caught in the chicken wire in the coop. And it just couldn't get off the ground. And he was pleading to my father, you know. And my father just reached out, and his hand was like King Kong's hand. Great big hand, you know. And I remember my brother Jack putting that pigeon right in his hand. It was like a nest. And I can hear that pigeon right now, as though he felt so safe. Now, I don't know what the hell my father did. He fooled around with his wing a little bit, and he took some strings out of his undershirt, and he went like that, and he had a popsicle stick he took out of the gutter, and he fooled around with it, and put the pigeon down, and flew away. So gentle. So gentle. And oh, he was the greatest guy. You know, my father didn't go to church either. And Sunday mornings, you know, his church was the Elks Club. And he used to take me with him to the Elks Club every Sunday morning. God, how I loved that. We'd walk right through a little Italy. None of them little wop bastards wanted my ass then. I'd be holding on to my old man's hand, you know, nobody fooled with me then, nobody touched me then. And my father didn't laugh, he roared. Everybody knew my father. You can hear him 3 blocks. He laughed. He wore a derby. And we'd go past the bakery, and the baker would come out and give me a bag with some cookies, give these to your mama, and then we'd go past the produce guy, he'd give you a bag of plums, and this guy'd give you, everybody always giving me things, you know. And my father would always give money out to guys and doing things and waving to people. And it was sort of a very festive thing, you know, Sunday morning. And I'd hold that hand, you know. And my father knew everything. He knew why the sky was blue. He knew why grass was green. He knew why butterflies were different. Anything I asked him, he had the answer. I realize now it was probably mostly bullshit. But I didn't know that then. And boy, he was a dreamer. God, he was a dreamer. We were standing there in the Hudson River on Riverside Drive one day. And he says, you know, he says, next weekend's your birthday, October 27th. He says, I think I'm going to do something special for your birthday this year. I got all excited. What are you going to do, Dad, you know? He said, I think I'll bring the whole United States Navy into the Hudson River just for you. I, what are you, crazy? What are you talking about? We went down there the next weekend, and there they were, battleships lined up. whole goddamn fleece was all over half. A few years later, I found out that my natal birthday coincides with Navy Day, too. You know? But that's how my father was, you know. And not that I would ever represent my father to you or anybody else as the image of God, but that's how I understand God. I understand God as I understood my father. You know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I get to talk to my father every morning, every night. I'll talk to my father tonight. Anytime I want to, I can talk to my father. I just say, dear God, you know. And he gives me the answers just like he gave me the answers then. And somehow I know I'm always holding his hand. I know I'm always in the presence of God. As long as I'm in the presence of God, I dispel all kinds of fear. I have no fear of nothing. Because fear would be a disbelief in the power of this God. And so I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable with God as I understand him now. And I should really apologize, I guess, for, you know, telling you this kind of stuff. Because maybe you don't want to hear that, you know. And I can understand that. I can understand how some of you in here right now are saying, "What the hell? Some down here listening to that God shit," you know. Because I would have said that. I would have said that many, many. 1950, I could hear myself saying that. What the hell, I get myself into a bunch of goddamn religious nuts. Those are the kind of things I thought. And I can understand some of you sitting right out there denying the power of God. But now I want to show you what a cocky, self-centered asshole I really am. Because I'm going to prove to you tonight not only the existence of God, but the power of God. And that's a pretty rough thing for a jerk like me to be saying. I certainly wouldn't be saying it if I didn't think I could prove it. And I can. First off, remember what it said? God could and would if he was sought. So you got to take a little time to seek back in your lives, too. As I had to go back in mine. Maybe it wasn't a parochial school in Mount Vernon, New York. Maybe it wasn't a graduation into a high school. Maybe your brother wasn't sick. But every one of you has had the presence of God in your lives at some time or another. And the evidence is there if you seek it. Seek it. If you need a little help, let me help you. Talk to me. Please, by a show of hands, how many of you in this room are fathers? Well, I won't have any problem with you guys, will I? You all know about God, don't you? Or have you forgotten? Let me please remind you with understanding. Let me remind you about that time in your life when the most precious thing in your life is about to present you with a child. Your child. Do you remember that time? Remember how they probably just wheeled her off now into that labor room where she's going to experience the most excruciating pain known on the face of this earth. A pain that no man will ever know. In order to give you a child. And I wasn't with you, but I'll tell you what you were saying out there in the hallway. Oh, God. Hey, God, I don't really give a damn if he's a boy or a girl. Let me tell you, I better give it now, God. I just want a normal kid. Nothing special, God. Just make sure he has arms and legs. I want nothing special. And don't let nothing happen to him, God. And if you say you never said that, you have never been a father. You have never been a father. And I imagine in this room right now are probably veterans of our last four wars. Desert Storm, Korea, Vietnam, my war, World War II. Are you going to tell me you never talked to God? I don't know about your war, but in my war, we used to say there are no atheists in foxholes. And if you say you were in a war and you never prayed to God, you never went to war. What I'm trying to tell you is the evidence of the truth abounds, abounds. It's all around us. And it's just like those men said, if he was sought, and I guess that's part of our illness, that self-centered, egotistical jerk like me and you have to have it proven to us. And God gave us the avenue of truth by asking you to seek the evidence, asking you to do something. So the next time you hear somebody tell you that, there's no guarantee, you just think for a minute. No sure thing. There's no sure thing in life, period. But boy, this is the closest to the favorite that I've ever known. This is what you would call betting chalk. You know. But again, I imagine there's some people in here that can't accept this. And I know that. They knew that 53 years ago when they wrote this book. Unless you haven't gotten that far in the book. Because right there in the fifth chapter, I believe it says, how does it say? Despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves the exception to the rule. And I'm not a guy that's known too much for his talk. I have to remind myself of the seriousness of this gathering. This is to be a life and death situation. You and I know or should know, and we should not be so naive to believe that everybody in this room right now is finished drinking. Because that isn't how it is. There are people in this room who will drink again. People in this room who will use drugs again. There are people in this room who are going to die using the drug of their choice. And sometimes I think they're the people that deny the opportunity to seek this power. And they're the ones that have to be proven over and over again the existence of this power. So, all right, I'll prove it. I'll ask any of you in this room to do something just for tonight. I'm going to ask you to pray, whatever your definition of praying is. You don't have to go through any of that formalized process of holding your hands and getting down on your knees. You're just going to do a little talking. That's all you're going to do, a little talking to a God as you understand him, whatever you understand. And if you happen to be in a position where you have to share a room with somebody and you don't want to display this obvious sign of weakness by praying, do like we do in the penitentiary. Put the blanket over your head and they'll think you're masturbating. Then I'm going to ask you to pray. Here's all I want you to say. God, make tomorrow, which is going to be Sunday, a better day for. Then you put the name of anybody you want in there. In other words, God, make tomorrow a better day for Joe. Then sign off. Shut up. Go to sleep. And when you wake up tomorrow morning, don't you tell anybody who you prayed for tonight. You just keep that between you and God. And then I challenge you. I challenge you to observe what takes place tomorrow in the life of the person that you pray for tonight. I challenge you. And why can I be so sure of that? Simple. Is there any amongst us this evening here in Auburn who is so full of denial, so egotistical, so self-centered that you can deny that it's quite possible that the only reason you and I sit here with some semblance of dignity back in our lives is the direct result of somebody else's prayer? Your mother, your father, somebody's prayed for you. And if you sit out here denying prayer, then are we right? Me and you, we're right. And a million little kids who are on their knees all over the world right this very moment are wrong. How could that be?